Okay, everyone, let's get started. Today is September 7th, 2018, and we at MitoAction are so honored to have Dr. Amel Cara sharing her time with our Mito community. It's just amazing. I am Mary Beth Hollinger. I am with MitoAction as a Director of Support, Advocacy, and Education, and I love my position here. I am working with patients, and that has always been my heart's desire, so I am so happy. We are just so honored to have Dr. Cara here sharing her time. She will be highlighting the work the MMS, or Mitochondrial Medicine Society, has been doing, with a special emphasis on the much-needed and highly anticipated and used mitochondrial disease standards of care. I've reminded everyone to go to mitoaction.org to find our slides. If you're having trouble with that, shoot me that email at marybeth@mitoaction.org, and I'll help you out with that. I am so humbled to introduce Dr. Cara. She has devoted her life to her patients and finding ways to give them a better life despite having a tough diagnosis. I just can't go on about how she's increased awareness, spearheaded the spread of education about this disease, is involved in research. She frequently presents and educates about mitochondrial disease in very many different venues, and simply, she just cares. And that is a quality that we all so appreciate. If anyone is all in for her patients, she is the leader. Dr. Cara is board certified. She's an internist and a clinical geneticist and the director of the mitochondrial disease program at Mass General in Boston. During her career, she's always been intrigued by rare multi-systemic disorders and has tried to acquire a multidisciplinary training in basic research, clinical research, medical service that has just uniquely shaped her to become the physician scientist that she is. And that combination is so important in a relatively new disease space like mitochondrial disease, because we need both the physician, and then we need that physician that can take what he or she sees in a clinical setting, bring it back to the lab or research or something to find ways to help patients. And that is so, so needed and so appreciated. She is committed to being an advocate for mitochondrial disease patients and to educate adult providers in recognizing and treating this disease, because patients are often discounted as having fictitious or somatoformic symptoms. Dr. Cara is recently elected president of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. Congratulations. And she sits on the scientific and medical boards for MitoAction and UMDF. She is also on the board of the newly launched Mitochondrial Care Network, with more to come about that down the line, among other boards. I just love how she is committed to being an advocate for her mitochondrial disease patients and their families, while also educating adult providers in recognizing and treating mitochondrial patients within the community. We all know how needed that is just by the length of time it takes most adults to get a diagnosis. Adult mito patients are often found that they're in the wrong office for too long, like maybe they were told they had lupus or MS or chronic fatigue or something else that wasn't just quite right. So Dr. Cara is out there helping other providers recognize that maybe this patient has mito, which is awesome. So thank you so much, and welcome, Dr. Cara. We are so excited to hear what you have to say about the standards of care and anything else going on at the MMS.
Thank you, Mary Beth and Cara and MitoAction, for giving me this opportunity to talk to you today. So I'm here on behalf of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, and I'm going to go through the slides. I understand we're not seeing the same slides, so I'll make sure to remember to reference the number of the slides I'm on. I would like to acknowledge Dr. Sumit Parikh, who offered some of his slides for this presentation. And I wanted to start by giving you a little bit of a historical of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. This is a medical society that is actually celebrating its 20th year anniversary this year. It was funded by two brilliant clinicians, Dr. Richard Haas and Dr. Bob Navio, in 1998. At the time, where very few people knew about mitochondrial disease at all. to put it in perspective, the first patient ever described with a mitochondrial disease was in 1962. That was a time where it wasn't even called mitochondrial disease. And then it's only in the mid-80s where we started actually discovering that mitochondrial disease was a genetic condition and discovered the first gene. And since then, it hasn't been long since we started discovering that mitochondrial disease is not one disease. It's a group of many different disorders that share similar clinical symptoms, but are very different and very heterogeneous in terms of their genetic makeup. So compared to other disorders that we commonly deal with, such as heart disease and diabetes, mitochondrial disorders are fairly new and fairly young field in medicine. And the way we doctors provide care for our patient is really through expertise gathered throughout the years. So when we look to mitochondrial disorders and the field in general, such a young field has not had enough time and enough numbers of patients to really gather that valuable information to help steer our clinical work on a day-to-day basis. So this is something to keep in mind as we go through the presentation. So in 1998, Dr. Navio and Dr. Haas, being two doctors who started to see mitochondrial patients, decided to create the Mitochondrial Medicine Society as a way to bring together similar clinicians who are also seeing mitochondrial diseases and to put their heads together in terms of how do we manage a mitochondrial disease patient. This is a new disease. We have no idea what it means, what symptoms are the patients going to develop as they grow older. So over the years, the Mitochondrial Medicine Society has been steered by primarily clinicians who are in the trenches seeing patients on a day-to-day basis, and has also tried to come up with sound recommendation in terms of how do you recognize a mitochondrial disease, how do you diagnose a mitochondrial disease, and how do you treat the mitochondrial disease patient and manage their problems on a day-to-day basis. And over these 20 years, we have learned so much, and our knowledge is changing at a very, very fast rate. And just in the last 5 years, we have accumulated a lot of new knowledge, and we continue to discover new mitochondrial disorders on a yearly basis. So this is an ongoing process, and I wanted to take the opportunity today to tell you a little bit about how that process goes and why is it so difficult that when you come to our clinic and ask us simple questions about what should I eat and how should I exercise, we don't always have the right answers for you, because this is a long process that has to go through rigorous research and rigorous gathering of information. So we're going to go through that, and I'm going to try to explain what the Mitochondrial Medicine Society has been doing since the early 2000s. So the MMS has a membership, and the membership has grown over the years and includes physicians, nurses, genetic counselors, and other healthcare professionals. So these are people who have been involved in clinical care directly. And most of these projects are done through the membership. So since 2012, we have been working on practice patterns, challenges, and trying to come up with guidelines of how to manage mitochondrial disease patients that culminated in these three papers that you see on slide number four, published in 2013, 15, and 2017. So most mitochondrial medicine specialists have cobbled together an informal set of rules and paradigms for preventive care and management of their patient, which is basically an anecdotal experience and theoretical concepts that they've gathered over the years by seeing many patients. And the questions of how appropriate and how necessary these evaluations that we come up with and the interventions that we put the patient through remain really unanswered, because we haven't gone through that rigorous process of showing that if you do X versus if you do Y to a patient who has a certain mitochondrial disease, the outcome for that patient is going to be better. So the questions that we asked ourselves were, how is mitochondrial medicine practiced in North America? And is there an optimal way of practicing mitochondrial medicine? And is there any standardized care at all? And who is in charge of the care for mitochondrial disease patient? Because mind you, when we started this process back in 2011 and 2012, we weren't even sure how many experts were out there who were seeing mitochondrial disease patients, how they were dealing with their mitochondrial disease patients. So the first step was really to figure out how are things going in the U.S. at least, and can we see whether we are all doing the same thing or if we are all doing different things. So the answer to these questions was published in these two papers in 2013, The Practice Patterns of Mitochondrial Disease Physicians in North America, Part 1, dealt with diagnostic and clinical challenges, and Part 2 was treatment, care, and management for the mitochondrial disease patient. So these two papers came about after we launched surveys to through an open invitation to participate in this project to all the members of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. We also sent invitation to the Society of Inherited Metabolic Disorders and the Child Neurology Society. These specific organizations were chosen because the North American physicians who identify themselves as seeing mitochondrial disease patients and being experts in mitochondrial disease come from specialties that are typically neurology and genetics and metabolism, so part of these specific societies. So we had 32 clinicians answer all of our surveys, and these were very long, 10 different surveys that they had to fully answer. And these 32 clinicians span 17 states and parts of Canada, and they are shown on slide number 7, where you have all the practice locations. And as you can see, there's a cluster, and there's always a cluster in the northeastern part of the United States. So what we tried to gather from these experts was really the how they managed to diagnose or suspect that a patient has mitochondrial disease. Do they use biochemical testing? Do they use genetic testing? Do they do muscle biopsies? How do they interpret the results from all of these tests? Do they use any specific diagnostic criteria to decide whether a patient has mitochondrial disease or not? And we also asked questions pertaining to the treatment and the management. Do they use supplements? Do they use many supplements at once in what we call a mitococktail, or do they use individual supplements? Do they use the same dose of supplements, or do they use random amounts? Do they monitor their patient in, through different organ system assessments? Do they monitor blood work, or do they do imaging studies? So these seem to be fairly easy questions and simple questions, but at the time, we had no idea how things were going and how doctors were really managing and treating their patients. So the results that we obtained was that most physicians did obtain some screening laboratory work in symptomatic or otherwise asymptomatic diagnosed patients, that some may obtain testing every 1 or 2 years, some may obtain testing every 6 months, some had sent tests, the tests that were sent varied between the providers, and the ones obtained most commonly are shown in figure number 1 on slide number 10. So as you can see here, there are rarely any unanimous consensus amongst all of these experts, something that they would do at 100% rate. And as you can see in figure 1 here, that there are some experts that might do check your potassium and sodium levels, some might check your liver function test, and some might do hemoglobin A1C as a marker of diabetes, but not all of them. And in terms of other testing like imaging and assessing the heart and the eyes, figure 2 shows also that there is even less consensus on how many tests were done and whether they are done on a regular basis or not. We also tried to dig deeper, and I'm not showing all the results from these studies, that they are available online if you are interested in reading them thoroughly. But the table on the right side of this slide also shows the management during the what we call catabolic stresses. These are decompensations that the patients go through, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. If you get an infection or if you're sick, you might feel your symptoms flare up. So in these surveys, everyone agreed that their patient had a specific conflict management during periods of stress, but they didn't agree on how they manage these stress periods. So some people might require their patients to get hospitalized. Some people might just treat them at home. Some people might give them IV fluids. Some doctors didn't. So there was a lot of discrepancy between what was being done within the U.S. for mitochondrial disease patients. So the practice, what this taught us is that the practice of mitochondrial medicine among all these experts that responded to the survey was in some way similar, but in other ways quite different. It showed that overall, the clinic structure where these experts were practicing and the organizations of their clinic was similarly aligned. So most of these clinics were staffed by geneticists, neurologists, or both. Most did not have a dedicated clinic where they saw the patient, so they had scattered patient amongst other different patients from their specialty that they saw on the same day. Most clinics lacked staff support and were underfunded. But there were also some similarity in terms of how they approached the patient and how they diagnosed the patient. There were notable differences, including the interpretation of those test results. So even though we talk about them as biochemical and genetic and muscle biopsy tests, every one of us interpreted them in a different way. And that way was dependent really on the level of expertise of that person, the specific patient at hand, the specific symptom that that patient was exhibiting. So there was also variability in the treatment and the preventive care approaches that these experts relate to us. And while most physicians recommended the use, for example, of vitamins, the actual regimen used differed considerably between the providers. So we surveyed 32 people and we got 32 different answers. And that just shows you that in something that everyone agreed that they were doing, which is prescribing supplements, they did it in a very different way. Selected preventative screening for multi-system involvement was also routinely done, but also differed as well amongst these providers. So what the survey highlighted was that there was a critical need for diagnostic testing and chronic care and treatment consensus guideline, along with additional aspects of clinical care for mitochondrial disease that needed to be obtained in order to harmonize what we were doing in the U.S., because we were all seeing the same patient, and whether we saw the patient in Kansas or in Massachusetts, the patient had the same mitochondrial disease and needed to be treated the same way. So So how do we go by establishing these guidelines? We wanted to come up with a unified consensus guideline, really to harmonize these medical practices within the U.S. And when you look at how these guidelines are developed across medicine and the scientific field, there are a few ways to doing that, and this is highlighted on slide number 13. So the way to develop consensus scientifically is either to use what we call an evidence-based approach, which means integrating the clinical knowledge and the skills with the best critically appraised evidence available to us clinician, as well as incorporating patient values and preferences in order to make an informed clinical decision. What this means in layman's term is that we need to have some scientific proof that an intervention really works. So for example, if I want to see if telling someone with diabetes not to eat sweets every day is going to be very beneficial to their health, I have to develop a study that chooses two groups of people, one that would eat sweets and one that wouldn't eat sweets, and then do all sorts of testing to show at the end of whatever period I choose to observe them for that those who didn't eat sweet really benefited from those who did eat sweet, and explain in what sense they benefited. Did their sugar level go down? Did they develop less complications? So these are evidence-based information that are used to come up with these guidelines. But these require a large number of patients and require a lot of money to come up with these studies, and they were not available for mitochondrial disease patients because this is a young field and we don't have enough patients to do these type of studies. So the next way to develop these methods is to use what we call eminence-based consensus, which is basically going to a prominent health professional figure that possesses many skills and knowledge due to expertise of having been in that field for many years, and ask them to opinionate on a particular health matter and take their answer as sufficient justification for that clinical decision-making. So although this is something that we all do, we all ask the gray heads in the room about what they think about a specific issue, it remains a specific individual answer that is based on specific personal experience, and not an estimation of really the real data from a larger group of patients. So then committee-based approaches where you put expert people in a room and you ask them to come up with an answer that they all agree with. And as you can understand, this is pretty much a match of who's the strongest and who's the best leader, who probably will win the debate and make their point and or their opinion the accepted opinion. So it doesn't always work well. And then we have NIH-style consensus where you ask a large group of expert in data managing and analysis, but not necessarily expert in mitochondrial disease, to get together and provide unbiased evidence-based assessment of medical issues by reviewing a very large body of evidence. This is kind of what the U.S. has done for the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and Community Preventive Services Task Force that tell the doctors when to do vaccinations and how to treat pregnant women and all of that. But this is not something that would work for mitochondrial disease either because we don't have enough information. And then you have the individual approach, which is I'm the doctor and I'll decide, which is already what is being done by all these experts who are practicing in their own clinics individually. So we did not feel that any of these methods was ripe for coming up with mitochondrial disease guidelines. So what was used instead is the Delphi method, which is really developing consensus in the absence of sufficient evidence utilizing a committee of experts. So the way this works is that you come up with a committee of experts panelists. You ask them to review and summarize what is available knowledge out there. So anything that was published, anything that was presented at a conference or at an expert meeting, case reports that were published or that someone has discussed. And then you ask them to come up with a summary of their finding. And then you ask them to come up with a list of guidelines that they think are appropriate, giving all the information that they have gathered and analyzed. And then there's a kind of like a moderator who is not part of that committee who reviews all these recommendations and makes a survey out of them and sends that survey out to the larger group within this this committee that is divided in subgroups and with each subgroup dealing with one specific question at hand. So the survey would go out to the whole committee and everyone needs to read these recommendations and score them by saying, yes, I highly agree with this statement, or I disagree, or I highly disagree. And then when all the responses are gathered, we make a list of all the answers that met consensus, meaning that 80% or more of people agreed that they were true or disagreed that they were untrue. And then for those questions that did not meet consensus, you go back and you recreate another survey, but this time instead of providing anonymous questions that only state the guidelines, you provide to the reviewers the scores that each question has obtained and why people may have labeled it as strongly disagree or strongly agree. And then you try to see whether by reviewing it that way with more information, that person reviewing it, that expert reviewing it, is going to change their mind and lean towards an end, one end or the other of the spectrum. And you do this repeatedly or as many times as you established your protocol until you get to that consensus. And then if there are items that don't get to a consensus, then you just state that consensus could not be reached. So through this anonymized process of summaries and surveys, the MMS has come up with this 2015 paper called Diagnosis and Management of Mitochondrial Disease, a consensus statement from the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. And this was a study performed by a panel of 19 mitochondrial medicine specialists throughout North America. They all had different areas of expertise, including neurologists, geneticists, clinical, biochemical geneticists, anesthesiologists, and academic diagnostic laboratory directors. And they all went through this rigorous process in smaller subcommittees, reviewing all the data that was out there regarding the diagnosis management in certain areas for mitochondrial disease. So questions that they tried to address included biochemical testing in blood, in urine, in spinal fluid, genetic testing for mitochondrial disease, pathology and biochemical testing of tissue. This includes muscle biopsies, skin biopsies, electron transport chain testing, neuroimaging, whether it's MRI or CAT scan, treatment of acute stroke, which was an area that was very important, especially for patients who have MELAS, exercise, which is something that we often get asked about, anesthesia and how to handle stress during surgery and after the surgery, treatment during acute illness, because remember the first two papers, they showed that although we all agree that treatment needs to be different during illness, we didn't agree at all about what needed to be done during that period. And also treatment with vitamins and supplements, because if there's anything we know about mito patients is that whether we prescribe or don't prescribe, they all take vitamins and supplements. And we wanted to come up with a more scientifically sound evidence that being on these supplements and how much of these supplements need to be taken was a little bit more clear to the patient. So this paper was not really intended to replace the clinical judgment of the doctor seeing the patient and cannot really apply to every individual case or condition that might arise from the mitochondrial disease group. It also does not address the potential for inconsistent interpretation between diagnostic laboratories in regards to these metabolic tests and pathology of tissues. But they are meant to really help guide the clinician who ultimately remains the one to make that ultimate decision because we are not seeing the patient in real time. This is kind of an academic exercise. So ultimately, the clinician who is seeing the patient would need to read these guidelines and use them in the day-to-day care for the patient, but really adjust them and choose to use or
I think we may have lost Dr. Kara for a minute there. Dr. Kara, are you on? Oh, we'll give her a minute to get back with us. Hang on one second. I'm going to try and text her because you may not know that her call has dropped. Okay, I am in that process. So I, for the moment, will unmute the phone calls in case there anyone would like to discuss what has been said. And when she pops back on, we will go back to meeting. So let me unmute.
The conference is now in talk mode.
All right, so it seems that Dr. Kara has momentarily dropped off the call. She must have had a glitch with her phone, and I know that since she's talking basically in a vacuum, she may not know that. So we're in the process of calling her, and this has not happened before, so this is a little bit new to us. But she has gotten through quite a few of her slides, and it is very interesting to me that the consensus of what to do in every situation was not on the tip of everyone's tongue, that all of the doctors in this survey from across the world had a slightly different flavor of care based on their experience with mitochondrial disease patients. And that is how they had to do it, because they just didn't have a manual or a textbook or a journal article to refer to say, this is what you do. Your patient has strep throat. Here's the antibiotics that work, and avoid these others. They did not have that sort of textbook of a standard of what to do. So they were each using their own judgment and their own experience to come up with their care. So I can see how then getting all together and pulling in from many different doctors from different parts of the country and the world would cause a little, well, no, I don't do that, or why don't you do this kind of thing? I never tried that. So it is very interesting, and I'm sure that these, the consensus criterion or the standards of care will, as in any disease, change over time. A new medication is discovered or a new therapy. So it's very interesting. I didn't know if anyone had any comments on that as we wait for Dr. Kara to jump back on our call.
Yeah, I mean, this is Jacob. Good afternoon to you.
Hi,
Jacob. Yeah, I just want to make a comment. And, yeah, basically I'm dealing with this unknown, I mean, for 9 years, and I still don't have a diagnosis. I don't know whether it's mitochondria or not. And I'm stuck here, and I don't know where to go, and I don't know if what she's saying is going to help me or how it's going to help me.
Mm-hmm. Well, she will discuss the, you know, what their statement is on genetic testing and those results, and I do have a question already emailed to me about the weight of genetic studies versus a clinical diagnosis in light of these standards of care and, you know, how she feels like, how she feels the patient without that gold standard genetic diagnosis still falls into this care module. So hopefully we will get her back. Hopefully there's no big storms or something up in the Mass General, Massachusetts, Boston area that her phone is totally out.
Where is she from? Boston Hospital or something?
Yes, Boston, Mass General Hospital in Boston. And what is a little unique compared to others maybe on our list of mito specialists is that she sees primarily adults with mitochondrial disease.
Oh, okay.
Most of the others are pediatric who may see an adult or two here or there. But she and a few others are kind of the more rare birds that, you know, devote their practice to adults. Has Dr. Kara jumped back on? Not yet. Okay. Any other?
So by clinical diagnosis, basically, you mean just by the symptoms diagnose if you have mitochondrial disease?
Symptoms and some lab work maybe, or maybe an elevated lactate level or your MRI. So more than just a symptom because it's too broad, but you have some of those either major red flag symptoms or you have some of that blood work to support it, EMG, you know, MRIs, you know, other testing that really is looking mitochondrial. Maybe you have, you know, some weird things in your eyes that are very mitochondrial-like, et cetera, as well as the constellation of your symptoms. But you just don't have that genetic diagnosis yet. And
so the genetic diagnosis doesn't show much.
Right.
So that's basically saying it's going to go by symptoms and others.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that's why one other question had come in about where those patients fall if they don't have that genetic diagnosis, but their team is still saying, yeah, we think this is mitochondrial without a doubt kind of thing, even without the genetics yet.
What are those symptoms that you said without the genetics or analysis? I'm sorry, I just missed it.
Oh, there are so many. I mean, you can get the biochemical testing in your blood and urine, you know, the amino acid profiles. You can have some muscle biopsy results and the enzymatic testing from that. Your MRI might, your brain may show some signs that look like mitochondrial disease. You could have stroke-like episodes, that severe GI issues with severe dysmotility and pseudo-obstructions. And, oh, the list is so long, Jacob. You could go on.
This is Mary Beth, right?
Yes, this is Mary Beth.
Okay, Mary Beth. I got the email. Yeah, no, I mean, in my case, I mean, nothing was found too much, I mean, except one thing in the genetic, which is inconclusive. So that's what I'm saying, where I'm going to go with this. I mean, if nothing was shown on all those testing that was done, all those panel testing, all the muscle biopsy and all that, nothing was shown, you know.
Okay, yes, that is that's tricky, and hopefully we'll get her back on the line to help us answer that question. Does anyone else have a topic that they wanted to bring up, or I could add to my question list? Hopefully we will get Dr. Kara back on the line. We are trying to email and text her, but I'm afraid that she's probably barricaded herself in a quiet office and is continuing to give the presentation without us. But we've never quite had this happen where we've lost the speaker at length. But I don't feel quite able to present on her slides. Oh, actually, we've just got notice she will be back on in a minute, so maybe there was an emergency on her end, so we can hang on. But I'm thrilled that she's coming back on because this topic is so incredibly interesting and important, and I love how she highlighted how infant this disease is and the impact that is on our care. So, and if it's in the infant stages, even for children.
Mary Beth?
Oh, yes?
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I think we lost power at Mass General, so everything went off. When did you guys leave me?
And I knew that you probably were barricaded in your office and not listening to any emails or texts. I thought you might be chatting on without us.
Yes, I was.
I think
so where did you
lost
lose me?
You, right around slide. Oh, hold on. Slide 17.
Oh, okay, so not too long ago.
No, not too long. We jumped right out. I'm going to go back and mute our line so that you can have quiet again. Hold on one second.
Conference is now in silent mode.
Okay, well, we will let you continue on. First
okay.
time that happened to Mel. I'll tell you.
Sorry. Thank you.
No, not your fault at all.
Okay, so I'm not sure where the call dropped, but I'm going to try to go back and restart from slide 17. So on slide 17, I was talking about the 2015 consensus paper where the expert panel has reviewed the biochemical testing in blood, urine, spinal fluid, genetic testing, pathology and biochemical testing of tissue, which includes the muscle biopsies and skin biopsies, neuroimaging, which includes when do you do an MRI, a CAT scan, what findings you might find, treatment of acute strokes, which is an important aspect of management, especially in certain mitochondrial disorders such as MELAS, exercise, which is something that the patients often ask about, anesthesia and surgery in general, what are the recommendations before, during, and after surgery, treatment during acute illness, because as you saw in the first two papers, there was consensus that it needed to be treated differently, but there was no agreement as to how different and what to do about it. And then treatment with vitamins and supplements, because even if we don't prescribe these, the patients take them over the counter and buy them online. So we wanted to come up with more definitive answers about, are they useful or not? Which one do you need to use? How much do you need to use? So the paper was really, this 2015 paper was not really intended to replace the clinical judgment of the physician, and cannot apply to every individual case or condition that may arise from mitochondrial disease. It also does not address the potential for inconsistent interpretations between diagnostic laboratories regarding which metabolite and at what level their changes are considered to reach clinical significance. So meaning that we can't really tell the doctor how to interpret their own test results that they ordered, but we give them a little recommendation about what we think is more specific and more sensitive to diagnosing mitochondrial disease versus others. So these guidelines are really meant to help guide the clinician that will ultimately make the decision, because it's the clinician that is examining the patient, that is listening to the complaint of the patient, that can bring it all together, analyze it, and take the best out of these criteria to apply to the care for that specific patient at that specific given time in the clinic. So after we did the 2015 consensus paper, we waited around 2 years and tried to assess what the impact of having published that paper was in terms of mitochondrial disease expert and their patients. So we asked the MMS membership 2 years later about whether they knew about the paper, whether the information within the paper was helpful to them or not, and whether they felt that there were other gaps that needed to be filled in terms of the management for mitochondrial disease patients. So 207 clinicians worldwide answered. These included neurologists, geneticists, metabolic experts, and 99% of them were interested in having additional guidelines available for assisting in managing the care of their patient. More than half of these respondents, like 51% of them, were aware of the 2015 diagnostic consensus criteria that were published by the MMS, and 97% of them felt that the guidelines were very useful. 82% of them stated that the recommendation directly impacted their patient's management. So this was very rewarding to see that not only did the paper reach its targeted audience, but that audience, the clinical experts, found it invaluable, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. And we did realize that there were still some gaps that needed to be filled for the day-to-day care for the patients with mitochondrial disease. So, and we realized that things might be done differently in different areas of the globe. So what we felt was maybe important in the U.S. may not be of same importance in someone who lives in Australia or in Europe. So for the next step, which is the paper on slide 19 called Patient Care Standards for Primary Mitochondrial Disease, a consensus statement from the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, which was published in 2017, we wanted to make this effort more international, because we recognized that mitochondrial disease care might differ from one country to another, but mitochondrial disease itself was the same, whether you were American, French, Italian, Australian, African, or whatever you are. And we wanted to get that perspective from these other colleagues who were treating patients elsewhere. So for that latest paper, the Mitochondrial Medicine Society Consensus Criteria Committee established working groups, and these panels included 35 mitochondrial medicine specialists. 34 of them were physicians, and one was a nurse practitioner. They were from Australia, two of them were from Australia, five were from Canada, one from Italy, one from the Netherlands, three from the United Kingdom, and the rest were from the United States. They had different subspecialties. There were biochemical geneticists, clinical geneticist, cardiologist, endocrinologist, neurogeneticist, pediatric neurologist, adult neurologist. And the aim was really to capture the current clinical practice in these different countries and subspecialties. So because we wanted this paper not to focus specifically on certain areas that were important to the mitochondrial disease patient as a whole, we wanted it more to focus on each organ that could be affected by mitochondrial disease, and we wanted it to be used not just by the mitochondrial disease expert, but by any subspecialist who might encounter a patient with mitochondrial disease in their clinic. So the way it was divided was by defining these subgroups into 20 organ or organ systems. Every subgroup had at least two members or more, and they were tasked to by reviewing the relevant literature and create summaries on these selected symptoms that can be seen within that specific organ or organ system and all the comorbid conditions that can arise because of a mitochondrial disease. So on slide 21, you can see the picture that you all often see on websites and publication with all these organ systems listed and what specific disruptions can be observed in each of these organ systems. And the paper really provides consensus-based recommendations for standardized treatment and preventive health for patients with primary mitochondrial disease. And for ease of reference and the use for these recommendations, we organize them this way with respect to the various organ systems commonly involved with mitochondrial disease. So we had sections on general symptoms and presentation, but also individual sections for the eye, the ear, the endocrine system, the GI system, the hematology, the bone, the nervous system, and all of that. So this new paper really expands upon and is intended to complement but does not supplant the 2015 consensus statement, which really focused on how do you recognize and diagnose patients with mitochondrial disease? How do you interpret these diagnostic investigations? This expands to what once you diagnose the patient, how do you really care for the patient? So it provides a guidance based on this international expert panel experience with dealing with mitochondrial disease. So if you download the paper, you'll see that it's structured alphabetically with sections starting with audiology for hearing to pulmonology for lung disease. And the last section is more of a general section talking about systemic issue encountered in mitochondrial disease, such as fatigue and exercise intolerance and pregnancies and things that we couldn't really fit in any specific organ system. And each section is divided into two separate entities. The first paragraph explains or gives you a brief description of what symptoms can be expected in each in that specific organ system when you have a mitochondrial disease. And the second section gives you the recommendation that we feel are important for that specific organ system. So for example, for the hearing, we describe what kind of hearing loss can be observed in mitochondrial disease patients. It's sensory neuronal hearing loss. How does it start? What kind of frequencies go bad first? And can it be aggravated by other factors such as certain antibiotics use? And then in the second part of the hearing is our recommendation to have a hearing test every year and to have and to avoid certain medications so not to worsen the hearing loss. And we talk about cochlear implant and how useful they can be for mitochondrial disease patients. So I would urge you as a patient, because you're often your own advocate and your own coordinator of care, to have a copy of this paper on you to share with your doctors who may not be as familiar with mitochondrial disease as your expert doctor. As I said, this was not really just intended for that mito expert that sees you regularly, but is also intended for that cardiologist that you are seeing for the first time, or that GI doctor that hasn't maybe seen any mito patient during their career, to educate them and to really guide them as to these are the things that you need to be looking for, and these are the things that you need to be doing about them. So on slide 22, you will see a table, table one, that has a summary of all these screening guidelines. So for easy access to all of these recommendations, we have developed a summary in a table format. So the table has all these organ systems listed on the left-hand side, and then we have three columns, the tests, or the recommendations that we think are important to do at diagnosis. So the first time you get your diagnosis for mitochondrial disease, these are the tests and the recommendations that we think you should be doing. And then after you're established and when you see your mito expert or your subspecialist every year, what are the tests that you need to be thinking about ordering? And then there is a section for comment. And again, these are to be used in concert with your specific doctor and depend on the specific type of mitochondrial disease you have and the specific symptoms that you have. So if you have a disease that affects your eyes only, yes, it's good to have an echocardiogram or a heart ultrasound initially when you get diagnosed, but if you don't develop any symptoms later, and if when we know that your disease is specific to the eye and there's very, very little chance that your heart might be involved, we're not going to recommend a heart ultrasound every year for you or every 6 months. However, if you have a disease that is known to cause heart problem, then you may need more frequent heart testing than every year. You may need them every 6 months. So this is really, this is why they are called guidelines, so that you need to know about them and you need to adjust them per your specific type of disease and specific symptoms. So if you don't want to carry the whole paper on you, you can just use this table one. We also have other tables within the manuscript, including table two that lists the subspecialists that we think might be helpful to have on your care team. table three also has the previously published guidelines for acute illness, anesthesia, and stroke management. These are mostly things that you can find in the 2015 publication. We tried to put them all in one place and summarize them well, and we updated them a bit. But these are the things that are specific to these acute issues that need to be dealt with for mitochondrial disease. And then on slide 25, this is an important table, I think, for you to know about, because it lists the medications to be used with caution when you have a mitochondrial disease. And I know there are many templates of this table and many lists out there. Some of them are very exhaustive and some of them are really small. There hasn't been really a good study looking specifically into a lot of the medication that we use in a day-to-day basis. There's actually a workshop in November to try to do that for mitochondrial disease specifically. So this table, I think, we put there with a shorter list because these are the medication that we felt had enough scientific evidence for us to be worried about them. And don't forget to read the footnote, because it says here that with the exception of valproic acid in full gamma-related disorders, these medications are not contraindicated and may be used with caution. So we're not saying that you can never be on these medications. Every medication that we doctor prescribe, whether you have a mitochondrial disease or not, comes with a huge list of side effects. So we always have to weigh the risks and the benefits of putting someone on a medication, even when they have a mitochondrial disease. So one thing that I am faced with regularly are the statins, because I see adults mainly. I always get this question, my patient needs to be on a statin because their cholesterol is really high, and nowadays everyone has to be on a statin with the new guidelines. So what I do is, if the patient doesn't have a severe myopathy or muscle disease, what I say is, Yes, we can start. We can start with one type that is known to have less side effects. We can start with the lowest dose possible. We can do a marker for muscle damage before we start so that we can have a baseline to compare to. And we can monitor the patient once we put them on the statin. We can make sure that they are well hydrated, that if they complain of new symptom, we address them to see whether they are related to the statin or not. So there, other than the valproic acid again, and certain antibiotics, these can be used with caution if absolutely necessary. Okay, so I finished talking about the paper, and I would like to take the last few minutes to briefly tell you about what the MMS has been working on. So it's nice to have guidelines, and it's nice to have an international effort to keep those guidelines updated, which we are hoping to continue to be able to do. But now I think the guidelines need to reach, again, those experts and those subspecialists that are seeing the MITO patient. So our questions now is like, who manages these mitochondrial disease patients, and where is their medical home, and how can we deliver these guidelines to them so that they can be used and can be beneficial to them? So one way of we thought about doing that is to create a setting where these guidelines can be implemented and promoted. And that setting was the mitochondrial care network. So we wanted to come up, and this is on slide 27, with a format or a network that allows us to standardize and provide excellent care for patients, improve quality and consistency of health services delivered while improving care coordination and improving a network to collect that clinical research and trial information to facilitate those evidence-based data that will allow us to come up with scientifically sound guidelines in the future. So we thought very long about how this network would look like. And when I say network, we really were thinking about other rare diseases and how they have centers of excellence or specific expert centers where patients could go and can get the best care possible for their rare disease. So in preparation of establishing something like this, we reviewed criteria for most of these successful centers of excellence that are already established for other rare diseases. We reviewed and we talked to a lot of people about how can we develop something that is successful without having to face the challenges and the pitfalls that other people have faced, and how can we establish a new network based on best practices for other organizations. And we wanted this to be a stepwise stage execution because we wanted this to be something valuable for the long term and not just something acute that we wanted to do because we felt like it. So a lot of planning went into this. We had focus groups with patients and their families during the some of the meetings like the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation. We had surveys through MITO Action to patients and their families. And the message that came out loud was that the family wanted to have multidisciplinary care and better social support and care coordination for their mitochondrial disease. It was interesting for us to see that when we asked our colleagues, the clinician who see the patients every day, they were 93% supportive of the idea to create such a home for patients with mitochondrial disease. And they did share the patient's concern about wanting a multidisciplinary care and wanting care coordination. So once we established some better idea of what a mitochondrial care network would look like, we got input from MITO Action, the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, and the Foundation of Mitochondrial Medicine, all advocacy groups for mitochondrial disease. And together we created a governance committee or a board, and we spent a lot of time rehashing all this information, trying to come up with the good criteria of how we should select a good clinic site to become an expert mitochondrial care site. A lot of thought went into this with keeping in mind what the patients and their families told us they wanted to see in such a place. So the criteria that we selected were based on the expertise of the doctors in the site, so how many patients with mitochondrial disease they are seeing or they have seen over the years, what the level of the clinical expertise and experience, what is their academic engagement, their availability, the comprehensive care resources that they have on site, the day-to-day workings of their clinics, and how many staff support they have. And we also wanted people who were engaged in advocacy for mitochondrial disease. So we wanted a good interface between those expert clinician and the patient advocacy group. And there are other things that we took into consideration to develop these criteria. So after these criteria were selected, we kind of asked people if they were interested in being part of such a network, and we asked them to submit application where we asked them a lot of questions about their care for patient and how they do it and what support they have. And we were surprised to have 26 applications returned to us. So we reviewed these applications, and the applications are shown on slide 31. And again, there's always this northeastern cluster of experts that see mitochondrial disease patients, contrasting with the lack of any experts in the center of the country. But these sites were reviewed, and our next steps are to really formally create these mitochondrial care network and announcing formally the establishment of these mitochondrial medicine centers that are run by experts in mitochondrial disease, and which we hope are going to be implementing all of these guidelines that the Mitochondrial Medicine Society has developed over the years. And those that network not only will provide the good home for these guidelines to be implemented, but will also serve, we hope in the future, as a conduit to gather that evidence-based information. Together with the North American Mitochondrial Disease Consortium, on slide 33, which is an effort that is supported by the National Institute of Health, we have created since 2011 an observational database of patients with mitochondrial disease in North America that every year captures their symptoms, their test results, their genetic abnormalities, to enable us over the years to come up with those evidence-based data to create better guidelines. So right now we have 1,343 patients within the registry. They are pediatrics, adults, male, females, and we continue to grow the registry. The registry used to rely on patients being physically seen at one of its 16 sites across the country, but we can now do remote enrollment. So you can contact NAMDEC yourself and ask how you can be part of NAMDEC remotely. And again, to finish, I know I've talked a lot about the evidence-based medicine, but this might change also in the future, because as medicine evolves and as science evolves, and even though in the past evidence-based medicine was really important, knowing whether taking a statin to lower your cholesterol level is recommended for people who have coronary artery disease to prevent their heart attack, we are now leaning more towards what we call a value-based medicine, in which an intervention is not, the success of an intervention is not really measured by an objective finding of a marker that you can measure in the blood, like your cholesterol level, but whether that marker translates into something meaningful to the patient and their family. So you don't know if your cholesterol is high enough because you don't feel anything, whether it's high or low. But what we know is over time, if your cholesterol is continuously high, you might develop a heart attack. But we want to switch from evidence-based to value-based, meaning that any intervention we do, we want it to translate into something that can improve your quality of life, or it can clearly improve your survival and prevent complications from happening. So it's a work to be continued as the field moves forward. and the MMS will continue to work hard on developing new guidelines. And I wanted to specifically acknowledge Dr. Sumit Parikh, who has been instrumental in developing and initiating all of these guidelines. So on behalf of the MMS, I would like to thank you and sorry for the interruption earlier.
Well, please don't worry about that, Dr. Kara. That was an awesome presentation, and it gave us a few minutes to kind of regroup and get on the same page and ask each other a few questions, so no problem there. And I almost think it's ironic that you are thanking us, the community, when really we would like to be thanking you for all, you and the whole MMS, for all of your work. And we understand how busy you are with clinical research and seeing all your patients and keeping up and the phone calls. And then on top of it, to tackle some of these very large worldwide projects is really quite remarkable. And even just to get something accepted and published in these very esteemed journals is difficult. I'm not sure everyone realizes you can't just write it and say, oh, they'll accept anything. It has to meet such strict guidelines and evidence-based and proof and this and that, that it's truly amazing the work that you guys have done in a relatively short amount of time. So
it's a
we thank you for that. Do you have time for a few questions? I know it's a little late.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. We had a question about lactated ringers. There's no direct warning in the standards of care, but many patients have been told in the past to avoid lactated ringers due to the lactate level elevation that's possible. Are you guys recommending to avoid it, or is it okay to use in general, especially if you don't have elevated lactate as your issue?
We do recommend to not use it if possible. I know the lactate ringer only comes up when a patient goes to a surgical floor, because from all the people I know, only the surgeons use lactate ringer. But yeah, for most of the guidelines, we do say not to use it.
Okay, great. There was another question about, given the standards of care, how do you weigh out sort of people with a genetically confirmed primary mitochondrial disease versus someone with a clinical diagnosis that just nothing is coming up on their genetics, but their team is still saying, yeah, we really believe this is a mitochondrial disease because of X, Y, and Z. So do those same standards of care apply to those people?
Beth, I was disconnected again. I'm sorry. I don't understand what's going on.
Oh, no. Were you? Well, you're back now. I was asking about... What was
yeah,
that?
Go ahead. I haven't heard the question.
Okay, I'll ask again. No problem. The weight of genetic studies versus a clinical diagnosis in light of the standards of care. So if somebody has had many tests and they just cannot get that genetic diagnosis, but their team feels that they do have mitochondrial issues or mitochondrial disease, do the standards of care still apply equally to them?
So that's a great question, because we do recognize that a lot of people may undergo through a very extensive panel of genetic testing and remain without a diagnosis. I think some of these patients may have a mitochondrial disease that is caused by a gene that we don't know of yet, or caused by some genetic problem that we cannot pinpoint with the current technology that we have. But there are also many conditions that may look like they are mitochondrial disorders and are in fact not. So some autoimmune disorders or some other inflammatory issues may look or sound like a mitochondrial disease and are not. We, in fact, have a new paper that will be coming out addressing this specific issue because we do recognize that it's a big problem in the era of genetic testing, and with the new guidelines recognizing primary mitochondrial disease versus a secondary mitochondrial dysfunction. So there is a new paper that will be submitted soon that discusses this specifically. What I would say that in general, it depends. It's really a case-by-case basis, because there are certain symptoms and signs that are red flags, like we say, that are highly suggestive of a mitochondrial disease. And even though we cannot find a specific genetic cause, we would still consider that patient as a possible mitochondrial disease yet to be genetically confirmed, versus others that have non-specific symptoms that may look like they are mitochondrial, but that we don't think is mitochondrial. So for the first group, using these guidelines would still be appropriate. For the other group, I think the approach would be the same, that they would still need to have a coordinated care and multidisciplinary approach to their care, but without knowing what those symptoms are exactly and without knowing the specific history of the patient, I'm not sure over the phone I can recommend for them to be using the same guidelines. There aren't too many specific things that we are recommending in these guidelines that pertain to mitochondrial disease, since we don't have a specific treatment that we propose. Most of these guidelines could apply to other chronic conditions, right? So if you have a problem with your heart, every cardiologist would recommend that you have a test that pertains to that specific issue. So the basics are the same. I just don't want to be giving any specific medical advice without knowing the specific case.
No, I totally agree with that, and that's a very good answer. I do think that the, you know, medical providers do need to keep in mind that, especially in someone with those red flag symptoms, that a negative genetic panel may not 100% rule out mitochondrial disease. Sometimes, yeah, I think that gets lost in the translation. Nope, your genetics were fine. You can't have this. And it's not quite true. So that's a good answer. And I think science will continue to change on that. And the genetics grows every year. So it's unfortunate that it's so complicated. That's what I think. We need one or two genes. That's it. Like some other diseases, not this. Oh, it could be one of hundreds of genes causing this issue. So
yeah,
that makes it difficult. Is it okay to open up the line for just another question or two and then let you be off with your day?
Sure. Just one
okay,
or two because I have another meeting.
Okay, maybe just even one. Okay, hold on 1 second.
The conference is now in talk mode.
A quick question for Dr. Tara before she runs off to a meeting.
Yes, I have a question.
Yes?
Go ahead, Irina.
Yes, this is Irina Campbell. And I would like to have a way to please be able to communicate directly with Dr. Cara. Is there any
okay,
way that
I think we can talk about that. Shoot me an email after, and that way, you know, we can discuss that after. Does anyone else have a question?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Can I go? Okay.
Yes.
So this is Lee from the Atlanta area. And my question is more of a curiosity, not just mine, but this came up in one of the local groups here. Dr. Cara, on slide 21, I see, you know, you posted all the organ systems that can be wrong with mitochondrial disease. But recently, the International Dysautonomia Group also posted similar organ systems for people that have a severe primary dysautonomia. Since a lot of patients in the mitochondrial disease group, they also have autonomic dysfunction. They can be very severe. What is the something that brings out to a doctor to say, this patient could have just dysautonomia, or this patient has dysautonomia with mitochondrial disease? Do you have any other symptoms, like, let's say, more muscle involvement or more neurological problems seen in patients with mitochondrial disease versus the patients with just dysautonomia kind of problems?
That is an excellent question, and that's the million-dollar question.
thank you.
I agree with you. It's a big problem. It's a big problem in the clinic because, yes, we do see a lot of dysautonomia patients, and oftentimes we don't understand why they have dysautonomia, and a lot of them get questioned about having a mitochondrial disease. So you're right that autonomic dysregulation can be seen in mitochondrial dysfunction, and the tricky part is really to to be able to diagnose mitochondrial disease definitively in those patients. So some of the red flag symptoms that I was talking about that we use are located on the MMS website. If you go to the Mitochondrial Medicine Society website, you will find a different tables with the red flag symptoms. So these are
right.
Specific neurological symptoms such as ophthalmoplegia and ptosis and objective myopathy and stroke, metabolic strokes and MRI findings and all of these. So in the presence of those specific symptoms and in the presence of a family history that is suggestive of a metabolic, of a mitochondrial disease, which I understand for dysautonomia can be very tricky because it also runs in families and you can have many generations affected, you would pursue more stringent genetic testing for mitochondrial disease. The issue here is, as I said before, even with all the genetic testing that we have available, sometimes we may end up not having a specific genetic condition. So in that situation, what I do is I say, I don't have enough evidence right now to consider you a mitochondrial disease patient, but why don't you check in again in 2 to 3 years, and let's see if I have better testing for to do or a better information. And then we... over time, update the testing and do more newer testing and try to come up with a better diagnosis. I've had many patients who have eventually been diagnosed with other non-mitochondrial genetic conditions when newer testing became available, and we had other patients diagnosed with autoimmune autonomic dysregulation as also on that side of medicine, things are evolving. So, unfortunately, there are going always to be cases where it's very blurry and it's in the gray zone and we don't have a specific answer. So I stress the symptomatic management, that they have to have good supportive management, and I see them, continue to see them, not as frequently as I would see a mitochondrial patient that is confirmed, because I don't have the capabilities. But yes, try to update the workup as we go.
Thank you so much. That's an amazing answer, and I appreciate for that so very much. Thank you.
And thank you for the question, Lee. Well, I believe we need to let Dr. Kerr go and get back to her patients and her meetings. I just really wanted to give one more very large thank you. For those in the Boston area, we are holding a patient education forum with Dr. Kara on September 29th, 2018, from 2 to 4 at the Newton Marriott. It will be a question and answer format, so coming with questions like Lee just asked will be a great opportunity just to really hit the nail on the head and say, this is exactly the questions that we have. And Dr. Carroll will be able to answer an assortment of questions. So appreciate your time with us, and I am sorry about the glitch with the power. Rarely happens, but it worked out just fine. So thank you so much, and thank you all for calling in today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Have a good day, everyone. See you next week for the support call.